Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. It's a fresh week. We've brought someone equally fresh. Brooke is here.
I was like, who? Where? Who's fresh?
Oh, come on, look at her. She's looking very ready to engage with news.
I'm ready. Mm-hmm. I am very ready to engage with news.
It takes a lot. Not only do we have the news, we also have the Oscars. Well, technically they had them, but they had them on Sunday, and we're gonna respond to a little bit of controversy around some of the awards that were awarded.
Uh-huh.
We've got two awesome guests who are gonna be joining us. So to break down the latest developments on Jussie Smollett as well as R. Kelly's arrest, we've got David Dennis Jr. is gonna be joining us on the show once again. And later on, we've got Ben Cohen, campaign co-chair for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, as well as the Ben of Ben and Jerry. He's a longtime political activist, a longtime supplier of my impending diabetes. Ben Cohen is gonna be on the show. It's gonna be awesome. And by the way, just a little preview. So Ben Cohen, campaign co-chair for Bernie Sanders. We have Nina Turner coming on Thursday, campaign co-chair for Bernie Sanders.
I love Nina.
She's great.
A great interview.
Yeah, I think you might have been on the show the last time.
She was on, actually.
Uh-huh. We had a lot
she's
of fun.
Great, yeah.
And we're inevitably gonna have Ro Khanna back on, the third of four campaign co-chairs, and we're reaching out to the fourth as well. So we should be talking with all of them very soon. We got so much to talk about. MSNBC trying to like put their foot in the throat of the Democratic primary. It's gonna be a lot of fun. Bernie Sanders with some advice to his supporters in advance of this primary. Very interesting. But we're gonna start off with the big news of the weekend. Senator Dianne Feinstein came across a group of young climate activists. And when I say young, I mean very young, like younger than the Sunrise Movement. But they're knowledgeable about climate change. They're passionate about addressing this issue. And they wanted to see if she would sign on to supporting the Green New Deal. And she decided to go in this direction.
Trying to ask you to vote yes on the Green New Deal.
Please. Okay, I'll tell you what. We have our own Green New Deal.
Some scientists have said that we have 12 years to turn this around.
Well, it's not going to get turned around in 10 years. What we can do.
Senator, if this doesn't get turned around in 10 years, you're looking at the faces of the people who are going to be living with these consequences.
The government is supposed to be for the people and by the people and all
you know what's interesting about this group is I've been doing this for 30 years. I know what I'm doing. You come in here and you say it has to be my way or the highway. I don't respond to that. I've gotten elected. I just ran. I was elected by almost a million vote plurality. And I know what I'm doing. So, you know, maybe people should listen a little bit.
I think the best advice is advice that you take first before you pass it on to other people.
Right.
So look, there is more to the video, and we'll get to the controversy around the video being cut down or whatever. But that was the part of it that really got people fired up, where she was talking to both the Sunrise Movement, but also the kids standing right in front of her. And I would have worded it a different way. I would have worded it almost any other way, actually, than the way that the senator chose to go.
I mean, it was very reminiscent of the hallway elevator conversations with Senator Graham, former Senator Flake, Mitch McConnell in his office during the shutdown.
Mitch McConnell today, actually, because the Sunrise Movement is protesting at his office today.
Weird thing to be so defensive. Mm-hmm. Amongst 10-year-olds. I don't know how old they were, but they look very, very young. And then when you could just listen, it's okay to just listen. I think that there's this weird battle when it comes to like long-term senators. And she brought it up that she's been doing this for 30 years. One, my first thought of that is that doesn't equal greatness. Mm-hmm. Because Orrin Hatch has been doing it for 9,000 years. Jeff Sessions was in there for 6,000 years.
Before the creation of the Earth,
would she consider their decades great?
Yeah.
Like they know what they're doing. It's not what you want, supposedly. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that really means anything. And I think there's this battle between like older senators, long-term career senators who want to continue to be senators. And then also they're like this pretending to care about young people and wanting them to care about what's going on around them and wanting them to vote and wanting them to be interested. And these are very young people who wouldn't have, it seems like if they, you know, stay in this same kind of mind state that they'll be voting right as soon as they're able to.
Yeah, they'll be.
That's what you want.
Yeah,
unless they don't vote for you, and then it's like, oh.
In other parts of the video, she's like, "Well, you know, if you want an internship or something, I'll give you an internship," and like. That's good, I guess. I don't know.
No, there were kind parts of the video,
but
these parts still happened.
Yes.
It doesn't change that.
Yeah, exactly. And yes, those kids will be voting. It'll take a while.
Yeah.
But they'll be voting. Some of them might be running at some point. You might be looking at a congressperson, and someday we're going to play this video and say, hey, look, that was them back then. But I love that they're getting so invested in this. When I was their age, I was miles away from any of the work that they're doing. Even the people, the chaperones, when I was their age, I was miles away. And so very admirable. But I want to turn now to some bad takes, both from Dianne Feinstein, but also from people around this. So the video blew up. Sunrise Movement puts it out there. It blows up because what you have is a senator essentially talking down in an incredibly condescending way to little kids. And then some people did what we now just we always do, expect it. Anytime a video comes out, this is gonna happen. Is that the whole video? Is that unrepresentative? And so everybody's like, oh my God, did you know that they cut that down? Did you know that those kids didn't materialize in front of Senator Feinstein and then dematerialize as soon as that video ended? So people were surprised to find out that. Now, Varshini Prakash, friend of the show and founder of the Sunrise Movement, pushed back saying, we're getting some pushback that the video with Feinstein was doctored. Number one, fact, the Feinstein video we uploaded is shortened because Twitter only allows you to 2-minute clips. It's not a doctored video. It is a 2-minute excerpt of a 15-minute video. Fact number two, Sunrise put out the full video ourselves. We've never hidden the full video because the full version is also bad. You can check it out yourself here, and that is true. That video was available. It wasn't taken by Russian hackers, like that they found it somewhere. Right. The Sunrise Movement put it out. Now, yes, they put out one of the most incendiary parts.
But
because
it happened,
it's so incendiary.
Right, it happened. It doesn't erase the fact that it happened.
Yeah, they didn't cut individual words
like
together. Yeah. That's what she said. That was bonkers. And there were other, so I just want to say one quick thing about
that.
There's this thing now, I tweeted about this morning. There's this thing we do where a video comes out and someone comes off looking really bad in it. And everyone is so scared about being wrong that, well, what if we're missing context? I don't want to have been wrong about this, that everybody's like super hesitant. And then more video is released. And even if that new video doesn't change anything about what you saw, people are like, oh my God, there's more. We got to watch out.
Right.
I totally backtrack. I apologize. Apologize for having an opinion. We saw it with this, Covington, a whole bunch of those things. Everybody is so quick to retreat. No, watch the rest of the video and then say, does this fundamentally alter my impression of the original video? And if it doesn't, then stop running scared.
Right. I also, something that she said about, you know, by a million voters and I won, I think there's almost like a lack of responsibility being taken from the fact that members of her own party tried to AOC her this past election.
Trying
season.
To primary, they, yeah.
And that should be something
partially
that alarms
running on
you.
The Green
you
New Deal, by
feel,
the way.
Right, you should feel relieved that you got in, not like, duh, of course I did. That should be something that should tell you, okay, a lot of people who I am supposed to represent are not happy with me. Mm-hmm. And instead of being like, too bad, so sad, maybe dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, and look, to the substance of this, her disagreement with the Green New Deal. Now, she comes back and says, I have my own Green New Deal. And let's go to this next graphic. We're gonna put it up. We took a look at it. Some of the components, not too bad. You can look it up. It's made available, by the way, because of that interaction. She hadn't released it until that happened. So some of it's okay. Here's the issue. I don't think she's gonna prioritize it. I don't think that fundamentally she understands the severity of the challenge that we face because of what she said to those kids. She said, well, you know, we're not gonna fix it in 10 years. And I've been around for 30 years. I think I know what's going on. See, here's the issue. If you wanted to be an incrementalist on climate change, if you wanted to take a gradualist approach, how about you could have started 30 years ago and then maybe we'd be okay. The issue is that when it comes to the environment, largely people sat around doing squat for 30 years and we've known about this issue since long before the 80s, but the 80s it was super well publicized. You knew, every politician, every senator knew about it and largely you all did nothing. And I'm sure you could come up with some fancy excuses for why you did nothing, but the end result is that we have very little time. We do not have time for the sort of gradualism that you still think we can do. You still think we have decades upon decades, do little tweaks around the edges and all that. No, here's the issue. When you're an older person, when you're a senior, I think that there is some wisdom that comes from that, from the experience that you had.
Yeah.
It didn't apply to this issue though, because you still have not learned what is actually going on. Those kids there understand the problem far better than you do. I know it's shocking, it shocked you, it shocks me too, but that's where we're at. So we need urgent action. I don't think that she will prioritize it as a senator. I don't think that she actually cares about accomplishing this on the timescale that we do have. And thank God the Sunrise Movement and those kids for helping lay out the disparity between people who get it and people who don't get it clearer than ever before on this issue. I wish that we had more time to talk about it. We do have to move on though. Okay. Lots of great content to get to. We're going to take a short break. We come back. David Dennis Jr. is going to be joining us to break down Jussie Smollett, R. Kelly, and more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We're joined now on the Damage Report by David Dennis Jr., Senior Culture Editor, Interactive One. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here, although I wish we had happier news to talk about. There's a few different things I want to get into, and I'm very interested in your perspective. So first on Jussie Smollett, we're still learning things day by day, more of the cases developing, but at this point, what are your thoughts about this entire saga?
It's bizarre. It's one of the more bizarre news stories that I can think of. We have an actor in one of the biggest TV shows around, maybe fabricating a story, being charged with fabricating a story that is based on very true hate crimes that happen, based on very real racist sentiments in this country. And we have a Chicago police department that is known for botching these sort of investigations, that is continuing to botch this investigation.
It certainly looks that way. Now, as each development has come out, people have been very quick to attempt to amplify what it means. And coincidentally, it always seems to confirm what they already believed about culture and right. You know, race relations and all that. You wrote a piece recently in News One about some of the things that you think that we have not learned from this experience. Could you describe those for our audience?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, a lot of the stuff that's happening is just confirming a lot of our biases that are already out there. What we have not learned is that people will use this as a way to sort of go against or, disbelieve a lot of the statements when people claim that these things actually happen. We learned that. I mean, we will see the next time that there is claim of a hate crime, they will bring up Jussie Smollett and they will say that, he lied, who else is lying? We have also, seen a very interesting debate about black men's role in all of this. There's been some who say that black men are not allies enough. There are some that say we need to step up and do more. When the fact is, we do see instances of, especially when things like this happen in the black community with LGBT people, they don't have allies in black men like they would like or like they need. So a lot of this is a lot of stuff that we already have confirmed that we already know about. The problem is that it's all being based around hearsay and he say, she say at this point.
And in your piece, you also describe how you were initially skeptical about some of the details of the story. Why was that?
Well, I mean, it just all seemed very weird that Jussie Smollett would go at 2 in the morning in the middle of a negative 20 degree to grab a Subway. And there were two guys who just happened to be there with bleach and nooses waiting on him. And as more information came out, the story got a little bit more bizarre. We see that the two men who are prime suspects are Nigerian men. They knew him. We have video of them buying hate crime starter kits at the store. You know, so it's all just really bizarre. I am skeptical of Jussie, but at the same time, what needs to be expressed here is that I'm just as skeptical of the Chicago Police Department. They have a history of shady investigations. We know about the Laquan McDonald situation, where it took them forever to even, arrest or bring charges to the police officer who murdered this young man, but they were able to turn around this Jussie investigation in about a week or so. So, they have had as much of their stories retracted as Jussie's stories. I mean, at first they were saying that the check for $3,500 was for the staged assault. Then they had to back off of that. They said that Jussie made up his own hate letter. They had to back off of that. So it's possible that they could be right that he lied, but what is clear is that they have botched it and they put out a lot of misinformation, which is par for the course for the Chicago Police Department.
Hey, David, I have been just like long thought that there was nothing skeptical, nothing, you know, at all about his story that didn't seem plausible to me. But I also saw in your piece that when you admitted like a little skepticism that you kept it quiet, almost that you felt like you had a responsibility to not say that. Why is that?
Well, I had to check my privilege as a cishet black man. You know, like a lot of times in these instances, we will rush to defend straight black men when these things happen, right? When we think about Mike Brown, when we think about Trayvon Martin, we are quick to throw out police evidence. We're quick to throw out testimonies in solidarity with our own folks. And so I had to wonder, you know, am I looking at this gay man who is experiencing this hate crime and I being skeptical because I'm a straight black man? So I had to really think about that and think about where my privilege falls within the whole story, despite the fact that I'm pretty confident in thinking that I looked at it objectively. But at the same time, I wanted to sort of make sure that I was being fair to the parties involved.
So I believe the last time you were actually on the show, we were talking about some initial impressions from the release of the Surviving R. Kelly docuseries. And just last week, there was a gigantic development where he faces now 10 counts of aggravated sexual abuse. When that news broke, how did you react to it?
About time. You know, it's about time. This has been going on for, as the documentary explains, it's been going on for 2 decades. His first trial was 15 years ago. It is about time. It looks like, you know, knock on wood, this might be it for him, but you never know. Again, going back to the Jussie Smollett case, this is Chicago Police Department, this is Chicago law enforcement. They have the ability to botch any case. So I'm hoping that they have enough to really nail this down. I mean, they had enough before, but I hope that this really has R. Kelly finding justice.
Do you think that this arrest would have ever happened without Dream Hampton's docuseries? Do you think we would have seen, you know, this? It's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, no, I think that the docuseries was integral in getting R. Kelly arrested. I think that it was necessary. I think that without that series, R. Kelly might have just lived the rest of his life abusing these women and until he died. And, you know, it's sad to say that it takes something like that, that is a grassroots effort from the victims, from advocates of these black women to sort of make this happen.
While we were talking about the initial impressions of the documentary and why, you know, some of the reasons that he was able to get away with this with basically no consequences for so long, one of the cultural aspects we talked about was how easy it is apparently for mainstream American culture to hear that a victim is a black female and just ignore it, to not care, not think that justice is necessary. Do you have any hopes that if he does end up in jail, that we might be starting to see a shift in that?
I would hope so, but you know, you gotta, as we mentioned, you gotta remember, like, this is, it took a 6-part primetime docuseries that was the top trending topic on Twitter to get a man to even get arrested for something that he's been doing for 25 years. So the bar is on the floor right now in terms of justice for Black women. I would hope that we can find a place in society where it does not take all of that for Black women to find retribution for the wrongs that are done to them.
I was also hoping to get your reaction to last night at the Oscars. The Best Picture Award went to, shockingly, The Green Book.
And shockingly.
I was shocked at the time. That was not, I did not think that was going to happen. And many people were not happy about it. How did you react to that news?
I was not shocked. Speaking of the bar being on the floor, my bar for award shows, namely the Oscars, namely the Grammys, are so far on the floor that I had no hopes for, you know, for instance, like Cardi B or Kendrick Lamar winning the Grammys. I had no hopes for Black Panther or Black Klansman winning. I was for sure that Green Book was going to win. I should have put money on it in Vegas, because Hollywood loves the narratives of racial reconciliation without having to really reckon with Black trauma or the problems with that. Mm-hmm. They love a white savior story. They love the idea that there was a kumbaya issue with race, and they were rewarded. We have seen this with Driving Miss Daisy, and the list goes on and on. Green Book, as people are saying, is the worst movie to win Best Picture since Crash, which was another kumbaya racial reconciliation movie. You know, I, on the bright side, movies like Black Panther do not need Oscars. It's a high-grossing movie. It was a cultural phenomenon. The Black Panther does not lose anything by not getting the Oscar. The Oscar loses credibility by giving an award to Green Book.
I agree. And any reaction to Spike Lee being recognized at long last?
Again, it's about time. But again, like, the fact is that, you know, them giving Spike Lee his first Oscar in 2019 is more of a reflection of the Oscars itself and less a reflection of Spike Lee. He's long overdue for Malcolm X, for Do the Right Thing, for, you know, his long history of great movies. It's a bad look for the Oscars. I'm happy for Spike. I'm happy he got it. But for this to, for any award to be awarding the first Black anything in 2019 is really a bad reflection on that award.
Yeah. Well, David Dennis Jr., thank you so much for joining us. We're always glad to hear your perspective.
Thanks, David.
All right, thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more news to get to. So far, candidates in the 2020 Democratic primary have shown little interest in diving headfirst into the mud. Mm-hmm. But the mainstream media is not going to let that stay for long. Take a look at these questions that were launched at Kamala Harris in a recent appearance.
Senator Sanders, he is somebody who, while he was part of the civil rights movement when he was a young man, has struggled to talk to Black voters and did in his 2016 campaign. Do you think Bernie Sanders understands the unique struggles of African Americans in this country?
I'm sure he does. I would hope he does.
Have you seen that in his previous campaigns? Do you think that he has done enough to try to talk to Democratic voters who are African American?
Let's just agree that the issue of race in America is a very real issue that everyone should be informed about and think about. I just sponsored a bill that for the first time will recognize the crime of lynching. That, and it was 200 years in the making that finally we would have the United States Senate recognize and pass legislation recognizing it to be a crime.
Okay, so we're gonna have more in just a minute, but that was two questions, a question and follow-up. Basic, am I being unfair to say she was saying punch Bernie Sanders in the face? No.
Yes,
you're being like nice and diplomatic, punch him in the face. And she didn't.
You're being unfair.
Am I being unfair
yes.
to Casey Hunt?
Yes, I think we're.
That's what it was for.
I think we're just gonna disagree on this one.
Why?
Because I think that two good things happened here. I think it was a question that needed to be asked, and I'll break that down in a second. But also, I think Kamala handled it correctly because
No, that's. We agree on that.
Okay.
She was great there.
And because there is this responsibility to do what you can to win, but, and not blaming this on Bernie Sanders, just saying you can see how your supporters can, to not, what am I trying to say? Maybe like help them not hate everyone else. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a responsibility to not be dirty.
Well,
in how you talk about the other candidates. But I think that question was responsible, because here's the thing. Bernie Sanders did have a problem luring in black voters during this last campaign. Whether we like it or not, it absolutely is what happened. And a lot of what you saw from, I think what I saw from his supporters were almost discounting them as uneducated, because you don't understand. Like, he did this, he did this, he's gonna do this. You're not listening, you don't get it. And there was not enough listening to those voters and why they had a problem with him and why a lot of them still do. And so I think it's easy to look at that question and take it as, we're trying to punch down on Bernie Sanders, but maybe we're trying to acknowledge people who have been ignored for so long and who have been discounted in their often very valid criticism of him. And so I think that is a question that needed to be asked. It needs to be asked often to many people. I think it's a question that needs to be asked, because it's a lot of people who are voting had a huge problem, you know, surrounding what she's talking about.
I disagree.
Okay.
I can only ever speak for this Bernie Sanders supporter. I can't speak for others. And
I
don't want to. But but I can say, I personally think that was largely a generational thing. When you look at demographic breakdowns by age of various groups, the story is a more complex thing. I thought younger African-Americans preferred Bernie over Hillary significantly. I think that everybody on Twitter is far too tribal, I guess is the safest word.
I'll go with that.
Towards the people that they support. And I think, I'm not saying that you're wrong, that there wasn't that from Bernie Sanders supporters. But I also received God knows how many messages during the primary from Hillary Clinton supporters that were not like, hey, buddy, come to our side. It's great, we've got cake. It was aggressive on both sides.
No, for sure. But the problem is she won. And so if he had won, then we could be talking about how her supporters hurt him.
I don't know that we would be.
I don't know either. But
from before Bernie was a thing that was talked about, there was already... His fans are Bernie Bros. There's only one. It's an 18-year-old white man with a goatee. That is the people that likes
Bernie. Whose favorite movie is Green Book.
Who loves Green Book. Well, no, I don't think that's still an older play, but I get what you're saying. That was the narrative. And it didn't matter how many women supported Bernie Sanders or how many African Americans or how many any group. That's not going to be shook. If it breaks down that African American voters prefer Bernie Sanders in this cycle, doesn't matter. Bernie Bros, that's my thing. Anyway, the reason I wanted to talk about this I wanted to give Kamala Harris credit for the way that she dealt with that. Because look, you can say it's a valid question, and that's, I don't disagree that it's a question. It's if you have time for four questions with Kamala Harris, or seven, or 11, is that one of the top four, or seven, or 11? Because Kamala Harris wants to talk about legislation, policies, that's what she turned it to. She doesn't necessarily want to jump immediately into trying to frame the entirety of Bernie Sanders' campaign around this one issue. And I don't want these questions about Bernie to her. I don't want some BS questions about Kamala to Bernie. I don't want BS questions about Andrew Yang to Elizabeth Warren.
The thing, like, it's not a BS question.
You're right. I shouldn't call it a BS question.
I want it to be
about the agenda, about policies, about what they're going to do.
Is it a BS question to ask Bernie questions about her prosecutorial record?
Because
this can be seen as a punch down.
I have no doubt that she wouldn't like a question like that. But that is about specific acts
him?
She's taken. Well, I would say if you want to do that, then rather than say Bernie doesn't communicate to black voters, say specifically here are things that Bernie did that negatively impacted the African American community, or that was clearly biased towards a different group. In the same way that you're not just gonna say, hey, Kamala Harris, she was a cop, wasn't she? You're gonna say specifically, here is what she did that people have a problem with. So do that with Bernie Sanders. Say, here are quotes that he has said that are really racially insensitive.
Would you have been happy with Casey instead asking Kamala a question about Bernie's support for the crime bill?
Yes.
You would have been. Okay, yes. So that's fair.
Anything, yes,
it just
definitely,
had to be more 100%. Specific.
And also, it's not so much that they asked the questions. Uh-huh. She asked a question, didn't like the answer, asked again. Then, we don't have time, we had another video. She brings on a different guy and asks him the same question, right, because her goal is the sound bite that says, I don't know about Bernie. That's what she wants.
I don't think that's fair. That's what she wants. I think the goal is to give people a voice. There's two sides of that. There is the black voters.
Mainstream media is not interested in people having a voice. And you might be right. We're gonna keep watching and we're gonna see. Is Casey Hunt, is it one time she talks about Bernie, it's negative, one time maybe positive, maybe neutral. We'll see if it flip-flops.
I just think you
can
look at
that question
two ways. And
if it doesn't, if it's a left hook and a right hook, and those were, I got my hands mixed up. But if that's the case, then we'll see.
I think you could. I just think you can look at it two ways. You can look at it as a criticism of Bernie and that's it. And you could look at it as asking a question that a lot of people have. Okay. There's two parts of that. There were black voters and Bernie. Two parts of that sentence. And let's not always go to being unfair to Bernie. Maybe it was being fair to black voters who have an issue.
Okay, I'm not saying I 100% disagree with you. It's more about—
It's like we're like 98?
No, not at all. Again, it's not that she asked the question, it's that she asked the question and then asked it again when she didn't like the answer and then said, okay, fine, I got a different guy, let me ask this guy.
Yeah.
That to me seems more like a tactic.
All right,
I'm not saying that there is no reason to have the discussion. And we will, and at some point Kamala Harris will, and at some point, I'm not looking forward to a lot of this primary. So we don't have time to get to it, unfortunately. Maybe we'll talk about it tomorrow. Bernie Sanders wrote an email to his supporters talking about how he wants this campaign to go, and specifically that we should be debating policy and not engaging in wild accusations and conspiracy theorizing and those sorts of things. We'll return to that topic more
in the future. I also think important to note that he did this last time too.
Before the convention.
Right, so yes. I think that's important.
Yes.
That he's always—
Thank you.
Yeah, see?
Whether we agree on whether Casey Hunt is unfair, Brooke is fair. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a break. When we come back, speaking about Bernie Sanders, campaign co-chair, Ben Cohen is gonna be joining us to talk about why he is supporting Bernie Sanders in this election after this. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We're very excited to be joined on the Damage Report right now by co-chair of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign and purveyor of, in my opinion, as an East Coaster, the finest ice cream in the nation. That would be Ben Cohen. Ben, welcome to the show.
Yo, how you doing?
How's it going? I'm very excited.
I'm rolling.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you about Bernie Sanders. I do want to also say, though, I grew up eating Ben and Jerry's. I've eaten a lot in my life. So thank you very much for what you've done in that area as well.
You certainly grew up straight and strong. You grew up very well. I'm proud to have played a role in the man you are today.
Well, thank you so much. So I'm curious, you were announced, we had already booked you to be on the show, and in the interim, you were announced as one of the co-chairs of Bernie Sanders' campaign. What led to you being a part of that extremely distinguished group?
Bernie, pretty much. He called me up. He said, would you like to be a co-chair? I said, wow, that would be an incredible honor. Anything I could do to help you become my president is what I want to put my time and energy into. And it was a pretty short conversation.
So you've been a political activist in a number of different areas for some time. What is it about Bernie Sanders that made you not only want to support him for president, but very early on in the process, when we have what is likely to be one of the most crowded Democratic fields in, you know, half a century?
Well, you know, I've been watching Bernie for the last 40 years. He's been my mayor. He's been my congressperson. He's been my senator. And he has been incredibly consistent and dogged in his determination to create a country that works for the many, not the few. And, you know, I've seen a lot of politicians come and go, but for 40 years, I mean, literally, I mean, pretty much as long as Ben and Jerry's has been around, I've watched Bernie and I've seen his commitment, his amazing energy, his courage. And, you know, from his experience in Washington now, he understands better than most what he's up against. And he's been able to overcome it and stay true to his values. And I'm on his team.
So you're going to be advising Bernie, and you're looking ahead to what this primary is going to be like. It's going to be a long one with a lot of debates. In your view, what would be the best situation for Bernie Sanders in terms of the topics of discussion that helped to shape this primary? What do you think his strong suits would be if we're talking about, you know, A, B, and C issues?
You know, Bernie has been focused on an economy that works for everybody in the country instead of just the ultra wealthy and corporations. And, you know, he's also spent a lot of his early years focused on civil rights. So what's his strength? I mean, his strength is a focus on economic, social, and racial justice. And his strength is sticking to it. And his strength is having the courage to go up against, you know, all the entrenched interests. I mean, the amazing thing to me about this campaign is that all those things that had been considered to be, oh, too radical, fringy, you know, pie in the sky, things like a $15 minimum wage, college that doesn't put you into debt, to get through, you know, Medicare for all. Now that stuff is mainstream. And, you know, so that's just a flavor for what Bernie is able to do. He's a leader. And, you know, so that stuff is now mainstream. I'm looking forward to see what his next ideas are.
Well, so you talked about some of the, I guess, the rapid shift that we've had in discussion of some of these issues. In terms of other changes that might happen, obviously in 2016, he came up short in the primary. In terms of how he runs his campaign, what do you think that Bernie Sanders and his team, including yourself, can shift? Like how might things evolve in this second presidential bid?
Well, to begin with, if you discount the unpledged delegates, Bernie probably didn't come up short. I mean, I don't know for sure. I haven't done the numbers, but I know that there's been significant rule changes with the Democrats, and you don't have those unpledged delegates anymore. But I think that the key to Bernie's campaign, the key to his success, is, as he said from the beginning, it's not about me, it's about us. It's about a political revolution. And he understands that he ran a campaign last time, and he's running a campaign this time that's based on a huge grassroots wave of support. And he understands that that's just the beginning. Getting him elected is just the beginning. That it's that huge grassroots wave that he's got to continue working with in order to get the legislative agenda accomplished. And so that's what really strikes me about Bernie, is that it's about us.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that message. It's been great talking to you. We would love to have you back on the show in the future as the primary develops. It's going to be great to see how this goes. We have such a different primary, obviously far more people, wider spectrum. So thank you so much for joining us, Ben. It was great to get a chance to talk to you.
Great to TYT with you. Keep on scooping and licking.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you. That was awesome. Okay, we are gonna have to take a break. When we come back, we're gonna have a little bit more talk about last night's Oscars, some of the controversy that flows into today after this. So last night there were the Oscars, and there were some highlights and there were some lowlights. So just want to give you our brief reaction to a few of the controversies that came in. The first and biggest is obviously Best Picture, the biggest award. Let's give it to Green Book.
Let's give it to Viggo. That's really what happened. It was a weird moment.
You made a great Strider, man.
Yeah.
I really liked you in Lord of the Rings. But that movie wasn't the movie. It wasn't the movie to get it.
Yeah.
Now, I will admit up front, I saw a lot of the Best Picture nominees. I didn't see Green Book. Now, you might react to that by saying, well, why are you talking about this if you're ignorant? No, but that's the whole thing. I, like many people, didn't see the Green Book for a lot of good reasons. Some because it looked like kind of boring, but more substantively because it played fast and loose with the personal history.
Because you already saw Driving Miss Daisy. That's what
I haven't, actually. I haven't seen it.
What?
I know, I haven't seen so many good movies. But you've done research around this, and there's a lot of justified problems with that film.
A lot, and I do have to say though, it is nice to see Mahershala Ali like twice in a row win the same supporting actor role, and then also be on the stage for Best Picture.
Yeah, I agree. He's a great actor.
But
I just saw him in Alita.
Great actor. Yeah, he's a great actor. But
And I feel bad for him in this.
I do too.
I do.
This was a movie that the family that this was based on had huge issues with the movie. That you didn't learn much about the actual Green Book and the history and the importance of that. And it was, a lot of people are calling it a white savior film. I mean, there's even like a joke about a part in it where the white driver introduces the black man to fried chicken. And it's just, there's so much going on. Not to mention, completely outside of the scene, the main actor in it said the N-word in public during a presser.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Viggo, and had to apologize for it. And then, you know, Mahershala gets humiliated because when things like that happen, it's humiliating. Whether you love the person or not, it is humiliating.
You want to know more that's humiliating?
What?
I mean, I didn't see the movie, but I did see them accept the award. And like, considering all of what had already been out there, criticisms around the portrayal of racism and how shallow it was and how in the end it's the white guy who fixes it all that stuff. When you get up on stage and you're like, the person who is most important, Viggo. Come join the four
this
old white guys.
This was based on a true story. That is just never the way to go. This wouldn't have happened without you. No, this wouldn't have happened without the actual human being that you.
And it's like, yes, okay, Viggo. So I'm sure he was great to work with. He's a great actor. He's gotten accolades for his acting in that and all that. But is that the time that you need to do that?
It was a movie very heavily about like race. And did you see like what the. Let's just see what it looked like the diversity on the stage up there.
Yeah, that was actually surprising because I, like I said, I hadn't been following this movie.
Yeah.
I thought that the team behind it would have been more non-white, but it was not the case. Now, there was a good amount of diversity in awards, both racial, gender diversity as well.
People were saying it saved Black History Month.
Oh God, well, yeah, but then it ended, unfortunately. Yeah, but no, I mean, you had Spike Lee winning award, you had Regina King, you had Rami Malek winning Best Actor as well. It was the only prediction I got right for the night, and he was great. I'm not saying that Bohemian Rhapsody is the best movie in history or whatever, but he was very good.
And he's a very likable actor too.
Well, the thing is also, I'm not that familiar with his work. I haven't watched Mr. Roboto or any of his other films.
Oh, I liked Mr. Roboto the first season.
Yeah, I need to see it, especially now. But seeing him on stage and how unlike Freddie Mercury was, I was like, oh, he's a better actor than I thought he was even. because he's not at all like Freddie Mercury. So you had that. Now, you also had Spike Lee. So Spike Lee, as part of his acceptance, he said this for Best Director. Before the world tonight, I give praise to our ancestors. What?
It wasn't Best Director, right?
Well,
he lost that.
Actor.
No, it was something else. It was like Best Screenplay.
Oh, Best Screenplay.
Best Adapted Screenplay, yeah.
Oh.
He should have won.
I wish it was for Best Director.
Yeah.
Now I'm a little bit depressed.
Now you're depressed.
Anyway. He said some great stuff, and Trump was infuriated and said, be nice if Spike Lee could read his notes, or better yet, not use notes at all when doing his racist hit on your president, who has done more for African Americans than almost any other prez, and sort of the subtext is, and more than Spike Lee did. But again, you made this point with the Jussie's, who's racist against MAGA.
You made the point.
Oh, I thought you did.
No, you did, and it was a really good point. I was talking to you after the show, but the president kind of keeps telling on himself.
So is it a race? Why is, first of all, he didn't attack Trump.
He didn't talk about him at all, yeah.
He implied that he's anti-Trump, but he didn't attack him specifically.
But he didn't. He said, let's mobilize, let's be on the right side of history, let's make the moral choice between love versus hate. The president could have pretended that that was about him.
That's true.
Like,
nobody buys that. But he says that's a racist attack to criticize him and his movement.
Like, I'm not.
But aren't there other people other than just white people in your movement? I don't really believe that a ton, but you say that that's the case.
Right.
I guess it's slipping out that they don't actually think that.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I will also just say, so Olivia Colman, her Best Actress speech, that just warms the heart.
It was adorable.
How awesome was that?
Yeah.
She was great. See The Favor. I know it looks weird. It's a period piece, but it's fun and quirky. It was good. All three actresses, Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone as well, were all great. Anyway, I wish we had more time.
I know.
Thanks
that
so much.
Fun.
As
thank
always,
you.
It's great to have you on.
I know. It's like-
and thank you everybody for watching. We will see you tomorrow with a lot more news for you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.